The following recording by the LA Sound Posse presents a critique by Dr. Ira Sohn of John Perkins' popular book called The Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Ira calls his talk John Perkins, Pro and Con. Dr. Sohn holds degrees in physics and economics and currently teaches economics at universities both in the U.S. and China. The talk was recorded by Dr. Sohn in West Los Angeles, California on August 15th of 2005.
It's August 15th, 2005. This is Ira Sohn. This talk is entitled John Perkins, Pro and Con, and I'm about to present a critique of a book that was published last year, written by John Perkins. The title of the book is Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Now, Perkins was a very high-level operative for the National Security Administration of the United States, and his mission was to supervise the development of projects in the Third World that were supposedly beneficial for the Third World. These projects would supposedly eliminate poverty by creating employment, advancing the industrial status of these countries. But in actuality, his mission was to make sure that Third World governments incurred massive debts that they could never repay, and thereby funnel enormous sums of money into the American banks and other institutions that he really represented. And also his mission was to prevent the industrialization of the Third World insofar as that was possible. Obviously, the Third World must industrialize to some extent, but the point of his activity was to make sure that it never did so in a way that challenged the U.S.'s advanced economic position in the world. Insofar as Third World countries industrialized at all, they were to do so in a manner that dovetailed with American corporate interests. The independent economic development of the Third World was utterly out of the question. Now, Perkins attempts to tell his story in this book, and insofar as he details exactly what his job was and how it continued the oppression of the Third World, it's fairly good, but it has certain drawbacks. This talk is devoted to explaining what the drawbacks are. Actually, there's one drawback, and you can see it in his preface. He says of his story, quote, "The story must be told because only by understanding our past mistakes will we be able to take advantage of future opportunities." In other words, he's characterizing the United States as one homogeneous mass of people, all of whom have the same goals and understandings, and he's also assuming that what the United States did, still does, to Third World nations, exploiting them and strangling their economic development, is some sort of mistake. Well, it's not a mistake. It's simply a part of policy. The U.S. Is a capitalist country. The firms in that country are competing with firms in other countries. The government of the United States works on behalf of its largest corporations, and the governments of other capitalist nations, they work on behalf of large corporations that are connected with them, and they have no choice but to compete with one another in the most ruthless way possible. Therefore, saying that the U.S.'s attempts to strangle economic development and exploit certain Third World countries are mistakes is like saying that when a lion pounces on a zebra and kills a zebra, it's making a mistake. Well, it's not making a mistake. Its whole metabolism is organized around attacking zebras and other prey and eating them. If a lion were to be prevented from preying in that manner, it would quickly die. In other words, what the Third World is confronting is a certain exploitive system. The system is not making mistakes. It's operating in exactly the way one would imagine the system would operate. Now, to understand in detail what is going on today, which can be called or is called neocolonialism, it's convenient to understand its predecessor, namely colonialism. So let's look back to, say the turn of the 20th century, to a country like Malaya, which was a colony of Great Britain. And suppose now that there was a tin mine in the middle of Malaya. Malaya was a major producer of tin that is owned by a British mining company. And the tin ore must be extracted from the soil and transported to the coast, from which it will be shipped to Great Britain. Now, a road must be built through a dense forest, and then a harbor must be built for the ships that will pick the tin ore up. And so the tin company, the mining company, rather than incurring the costs on its own, it gets the British colonial authorities. They dominate Malaya, which is today called Malaysia. They dominate Malaya, and they borrow money from large banks in Britain and perhaps France and other places in Europe, and they use this money to build the road. Since this is money borrowed by a government from private banks, it has nothing to do, really, with the mining company, which is the beneficiary of the road, and the loan must be paid back, the principal plus the interest. Where will that come from? Well, it'll come from the Malayan people themselves. They will be taxed in order to repay the loan. So that what happens is that the English imperialists realize a double benefit. First of all, the mining company does not have to incur a cost in building the road. It's getting the road for free, in effect. And the other benefit, of course, is that British banks take very high interest on the loan. Now, what might have been done with this money, or what's an alternative to the scenario that I just described? Well, if the Malayans were in control of their own government, they might borrow money for the purpose of building roads, but not one road from a tin mine to the coast. That same money might have been utilized to build roads connecting the main cities of Malaya so that Malaya would have a rounded industrial development similar to that of the United States or Britain or France. In other words, a division of labor would be worked out whereby different regions of the country would engage in different phases of the production of something. Each would specialize in its own activity, and a road system or railroad system would bind them all together, and Malaya could become a highly industrialized nation competing with England, France, Germany, the United States. Obviously, the English authorities, who were working on behalf of the owners of the English tin mining company, would never put forward a project of that sort. Insofar as there were infrastructure projects, they would benefit the foreign company and provide some work to the local Malayan workers. There was no progress that was discernible for long periods of time in Malaysia or Malaya, precisely because its economic development was controlled in this manner by a foreign power. It's interesting that the mining of the tin ore would not be followed by the building of refineries for tin in Malaya. If the Malayans could, for instance, mine their own tin and then refine it, they could sell it easily on world markets. In fact, they might fabricate the refined tin into high-value products that would be sold on world markets. The point to the policies followed by all these imperialist powers were to confine economic activity in third world countries such as Malaya to the extraction of raw materials, but not their refinement. Whether the raw materials we're talking about are tin in the case of Malaya, or copper in the case of Chile, or oil in the case of Iran. As long as only the most primitive processes took place in the third world, even should third world businesses be able to carry on these processes, they would not be able to refine the product and receive any benefit from them. So one can refer to the kind of development that took place under the great colonial powers as crippled economic development or maldevelopment. They cannot be referred to, these projects, as part of underdevelopment. The third world is not underdeveloped, it's maldeveloped. Its development has been thwarted and channeled and crippled by the powers that were in a position to exploit them. So what I've just described is colonialism. After World War II, there were upheavals in many parts of the Third World, and so colonialism had to be abandoned and replaced with what is now called neocolonialism. Point for point, everything that goes on under neocolonialism was already done in the colonial regimes. It's simply now done in a more masked or camouflaged way. Let's examine what Perkins's role was as an operative for the NSA, the National Security Agency of the United States. Third world leaders were encouraged to take out large loans, government loans, from large lending institutions, essentially in America and Europe, and use these loans for the construction of various projects in their own countries that would help foreign investors. The sums were gigantic, and the interest to be paid on these sums was similarly gigantic, so that the Third World drifted, and still drifts to some extent, in a state of debt peonage. They will never be able to repay these loans. Had the Third World leaders not been corrupted by the United States, Britain, France, the large corporations that control the governments of those places, they would never have taken out these loans in the first place. The principles of debt peonage existed in the United States, let's say, after the Civil War, enmeshing tenant farmers or sharecroppers in the Deep South, are exactly the kinds of relations that exist today in the Third World. Again, the whole purpose of these loans was not to see that the Third World countries developed, lifted themselves out of poverty, became economically advanced. The purpose was to thwart their independent economic development so that they would inevitably be exploited by the banks and industrial corporations that were involved in this system. Therefore, to say that what these institutions did was a mistake, as Perkins does in his preface, is itself a mistake. These activities are not mistakes. They're exactly what one would expect from capitalist societies. The different economic institutions and the governments that back them really have no option. American capitalists know that if they don't exploit Venezuela or Brazil or Iran or Malaysia or Indonesia, then their rivals in France or Britain or Germany will. And so what we're seeing is really a contest among predators. No predator can stop preying because if it is faced with powerful rivals, it must join in the general fray. Now, the effect of Perkins's characterization of it as somehow a mistake, the effect that it has is to induce Americans, and they're his audience basically, to imagine that the solution to this problem is not to take action against the system and eliminate the system. If the system is exploited people as a result of mistakes, well, then you somehow correct the mistakes and the exploitation stops. What particularly worries Perkins is that after decades and even centuries of this kind of oppression, the U.S. now faces the rage of groups all over the world that, since they can't organize into regular armies, have organized into terrorist organizations that begin to attack the United States and its allies themselves. In other words, Perkins sees himself as being part of some sort of reform effort that will reduce the oppression of the Third World and prevent the U.S. from being attacked by groups in the Third World that feel that they have no alternative but activities such as terrorism. However, this is misconceived. The large corporations, the industrial corporations, the banks that are interwoven with them, the governments that support them, cannot behave otherwise than as they do. Just as a lion cannot become a vegetarian. Its whole metabolism requires fresh meat. And by feeling that the U.S. or any of its counterparts in the rest of the world can reform themselves and not oppress the Third World and drive it to revolt is simply absurd. And that's the great weakness in Perkins's outlook. And it's a weakness that's shared by much of the U.S. left. It feels that if it can just stop globalization, or it can just get the big banks of the capitalist world to forgive a lot of the loans they've made to Third World countries, or if the expropriation of small farmers by Third World governments or by large plantations can be arrested, or the chopping down of the rainforest can be slowed, that somehow that represents a solution to the problem. Well, the problem isn't this bank or that industrial corporation or this corrupt politician. The problem is a system, the capitalist system, And until that system is eliminated, these oppressive policies will continue. Globalization or no globalization, the chopping down of rainforests or the preservation of rainforests, to adopt the policy of reform or the outlook of reform is futile, and in fact it wastes the energies of those who would like to see a change but cling to programs that are fated to fail. The way to deal with a lion that's on the rampage, that's attacking zebras, is not to try to reason with the lion or turn it into a vegetarian. The way to deal with such an animal is to kill it.
You have been listening to Dr. Irisone's commentary called John Perkins, Pro and Con. This recording was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We anti-copyright these recordings and share them via the internet, via community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of the creation of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard on this program, please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.